versus Terry Mortier. Pardon me. The United States versus James Rainey. I'm sorry.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Lisa Scott, and I'm with the Federal Defender Office.
Can you talk louder, please?
Sure. My name is Lisa Scott, and I'm with the Federal Defender Office for the Central District of Illinois, and I represent the appellant, Renee Hyman. With me at counsel table is Appellate Division Chief Jonathan Hawley. Mr. Hyman is serving a sentence that's more than 3 years longer than it should be because of an oversight by everyone involved in this case. The oversight resulted in the district judge giving him a 16-level increase in his offense level when it sentenced him under the illegal reentry guideline, 2L1.2. Mr. Hyman should only have received an 8-level increase in his offense level. And the 16-level increase that he got would have been correct under an earlier version of 2L1.2. That earlier version gave a full 16-level increase whenever a defendant had a pre-deportation conviction for any type of aggravated felony. But the guideline was changed in November 2001 with the express purpose of providing a more graduated sentencing enhancement and reserving the full 16 levels for only the most serious aggravated felonies. That would include those that qualified as a firearms offense or a crime of violence, as the guideline defines that term. All other aggravated felonies would only get an 8-level increase. Now, the district court determined that Mr. Jaimez had two crimes of violence, as defined in 2L1.2. The court relied on two Wisconsin convictions. The first was for discharging a firearm into a building, and the second was for injury by negligent use of a weapon. The only way those convictions could have counted as crimes of violence under 2L1.2 is if one of two things were true. They'd either have to be specifically listed in the commentary to the guideline, or they would have to have the use of physical force against the person of another as an element. Now, the important thing about that definition is that even though the term crime of violence appears in a number of statutes and in another section of the guidelines, in the career offender guidelines, the definition in 2L1.2 is unique in that it doesn't include offenses that merely pose a serious risk of harm or injury to another person. For it to count under this definition, it either has to be listed or it has to have the use of physical force as an element of the crime itself. Neither of Mr. Hyman's offenses qualify under this definition. Neither of them are listed in the guideline, and neither has the use of force as an element.
What about the waiver argument that the government makes?
There's no waiver in this case. A waiver would be an intentional relinquishment of a known right. And there's nothing in this record that suggests that Mr. Jaimez knew of his right to be sentenced without this 16-level increase. Not only that, there's no indication that anyone in this case thought about that.
Why is that significant?
It's significant because there's no... Well, when you look to the context of the change in the law, and you look to the fact that the parties recommended a 16-level increase that makes perfect sense under the old version because he's got two aggravated felonies. Makes no sense at all under the current version. There's no strategic reason for that kind of a recommendation. The only plausible explanation on this record is that the parties just weren't aware of the change in the guidelines.
So your view is this was a mutual mistake, in effect?
Exactly, exactly. An oversight by everyone involved.
What did the judge have to say about this thing?
Well, that's the thing. It might have been different if the judge had said something specific about it. But once the parties agreed to the recommendation that didn't appear to be clearly thought out, didn't even specify which convictions supposedly qualified for the crime of violence, that recommendation made its way into the PSR, and then the judge adopted that, and the judge didn't seem to do anything.
What did the PSR have to say?
The PSR said something slightly different. I believe it said that it cited both of the convictions, the discharging the weapon and injury by negligent use of a weapon. But again, no analysis, no specific reference to the meaning of the term crime of violence as used in this guideline.
And in the PSI, was a 16-level adjustment in the PSI?
It was.
And so that was part of the probation officer's calculation as well?
That's true.
So the probation officer didn't make reference to the change in the law in the PSR?
Not at all. The PSR does say that it's going under the 2002 version of the guidelines, which would be the right version, which is the one that has the change in it. But there's no, you know, there's just a short paragraph that says he gets 16 levels.
So the judge was misadvised by the probation officer and didn't catch it.
Correct.
Prosecutor didn't catch it. Defense counsel didn't catch it. Nobody caught it.
Right.
And when did this change in the law come into effect?
November 2001.
And the sentencing was?
I believe July 2003.
When?
I think it was July 2003.
All right, no, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just asking you.
But I think it's an easy mistake for people to make when, especially if you're practicing in this area, if counsel just looked at the offense level increase and didn't know about the change in the guideline and just thought, oh, 16 levels, well, that's right. I know that's right because he has an aggravated felony, which he does. And it might be more of a waiver situation if there was any analysis anywhere in this record. But when you look at the whole context, it looks exactly like Judge Ripple said, like a mutual mistake by everyone involved. It would be unfair to put the whole burden of this oversight.
Well, how much did the sentence increase?
This was a substantial increase in the sentence. Without the 16 levels, if he had only gotten the 8 levels that he should have gotten, he would have been at 30 to 37 months. With the extra 8 levels tacked on, he went all the way up to 70 to 87, and he got a 78-month sentence, so he's in the middle of that higher range. So we're looking at more than 3 years.
He got 78, and he, if the judge hadn't made the mistake, he'd be, what's the maximum he could have gotten?
37.
37.
I would also point out that the government seems to be in complete agreement that there aren't any qualifying convictions. The government just focuses on the one conviction for discharging a firearm. It doesn't say that that offense is listed, and it doesn't appear that it is, and explicitly concedes that that offense doesn't have the use of force as an element. The government, I think, is trying to shift the focus to the facts that it say underlies that conviction and say, look, these facts show that the victim maybe really was at risk of injury or force being used against them. But that's, in essence, asking this court to rewrite the guideline. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
All right, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Melvin K. Washington. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and I appear here today on behalf of the appellee, United States of America. The government's position is that the defendant waived his right to object to the sentencing guidelines applied to his case by the trial court.
Everybody kind of waived it, didn't they?
Yeah.
I mean,
no, Your Honor,
nobody caught it. Government didn't catch it. Trial judge didn't catch it. Probation officer didn't catch it. Everybody sat there convinced that the world was different than it was.
No, Your Honor, I beg to differ. The record in this case indicates that the plea agreement explicitly set forth that the defendant is subject to an enhancement for 16 points by 16 points based on his prior conviction of a crime of violence.
But the guideline had changed. I mean, everybody was asleep at the switch in terms of the time. Are you disputing the time that she's saying the guideline was enacted?
Your Honor, the change in the guideline took place in 2001.
Right.
And the sentence took place in this case in 2003. I'm not sure why there was such a rush to conclude that over a two-year period, persons were not cognizant of change in the law.
Well, nobody seemed to be aware of it. The court wasn't aware of it. It wasn't laid out in the probation officer's report. The probation officer said it was 16 points.
Actually, Your Honor, I think that the probation officer's recitation of 16 points is consistent with the facts in the case and the defendant's criminal history. He had been convicted of a crime of violence. And in this particular case, the trial court and the defense adopted the pre-sentence investigation report recommendation. The defendant adopted those, did not express any disagreement with them. He had more than ample opportunity to do so, and he did not choose to do so. And I think that is consistent with the facts in this case in terms of the charge that he was convicted of. discharging a firearm into a building.
Yeah, but you agreed that the guidelines were changed, and that means that one of his offenses was not consistent under the amendment to the guidelines. That is, it was not a crime of violence.
No, Your Honor, the government does not agree with that. The guidelines changed only insofar as the 2001 change in the guidelines with respect to what the operative offenses were that gave rise to the 16-point enhancement. The guidelines did not, however, Your Honor, change the provision whereby a person's base offense level could be increased from 8 points by additional 16 points based on a prior conviction of a crime of violence. That did not change, not one iota. And that's the government's position, is that at the time of the defendant was sentenced in July of 2003, the application of the crime of violence concept, principle, as a basis for an objection was consistent. It never changed. Just because there had been a change in the guidelines doesn't mean that the defendant was not subject to a still a 16-point enhancement for a prior conviction of a crime of violence predating his deportation from the United States. That's, in fact, is the case. And I might also add, Your Honor, that even this court has talked about the issue of when the waiver has taken place. And I note that in the decision from this court in the Sumner case, this court said rather explicitly in a case in which the defendant had, in fact, expressed objections to the pre-sentence report recommendations prior to sentencing. But this court concluded, even after those objections had been raised by the defendant, that the sequence of events indicated that the defendant knew he had a right to object and affirmatively decided not to. Now, in this particular case, the defendant signed a plea agreement. In the plea agreement, there was a stipulation to an enhancement by 16 points based on his prior conviction. He stipulated to that. After the plea agreement was signed, it was filed with the court. Between the time that the plea agreement was filed with the court and the time of the hearing on the change of plea, no objections by the defendant, no qualification of that stipulation. We got into court on the change of plea. No objections by the defendant, no qualifications whatsoever. The pre-sentence investigation report was sent out to him. He was given notice that he had to file objections within a certain time period. No objections by him, no qualifications whatsoever by him. And we got to the sentencing phase. The only objection that the defendant raised at that time was that through his counsel was that he sought to have a downward departure in his offense level. And that, the government respectfully submits, indicates that there had been consideration by the defendant as to what guidelines govern in this particular case. It was not simply fly-by-night operation or neglect or inattentiveness on the part of the defendant. He was aware of that. And this court said in Sumner, waiver, that's it. Right to appeal was extinguished. This court has no further appellate review in this case. In that particular case, the facts were very clear. Far stronger, in our case, in my submission, Your Honor, far weaker fact pattern than is here. Because in some, the defendant did raise some objections. Here, none. Stipulations throughout. And the government respectfully submits that there's been a waiver in this court under its own doctrine. It's precluded from reviewing this case further. And even if the court were to conclude that there had not been a waiver in this case, the United States respectfully submits that the defendant has no grounds for reversal of his conviction and the sentence in this case based on the forfeiture doctrine. Forfeiture, as this court has said before, and as the Supreme Court has said, is a remedy that must be resorted to, is a reversal following a forfeiture, is a remedy that must be resorted to, not just because there is a error, but it has to be a plain error. And it also has to be a plain error that warrants reversal because it violates substantial rights of a defendant that brings into question the integrity, fairness of the judicial process.
But this boils down to what is a crime of violence, and 2L1.1 requires the use, attempted use, or threatened use of force against persons of another. And haven't you conceded that the elements of the offense, of the underlying offense, don't satisfy that standard?
No, Your Honor, the government has not in no way, what shape, form, or fashion. We believe that the offense that he was convicted of, he went into the home of an ex-girlfriend, he grabbed her by the hair, he shot a weapon, shot at her, she ran from him, he pursued her throughout the house, she went into a room and locked the door, he shot through the door and shot at her. I cannot fathom how the United States or anyone could conclude that that didn't constitute a crime of violence. And if you look at the the Brady case in Wisconsin, which the elements of the offense are delineated, it talks about what is required. And the first concept that's set forth there is that the defendant intentionally fired a weapon into a building. It's right up front. Nothing to equivocate about. In this particular case, the defendant did that. And he was so bold as to acknowledge to the police after he was arrested and charged with the offense, he was so bold as to say, yes, I did shoot at her. I shot into the window.
How do you deal with Flores against Ashcroft and Vargas against Garcia? Cases like that that say you really can't look at the underlying facts as you've just done. You simply, I presume this is Judge Williams' point, you simply can look at the elements of the offense in the abstract.
Actually, Your Honor, I'm glad you raised that point and that question, sir, because in this particular case, the charging document upon which the pre-sentence investigation report was predicated was the complaint. That was nothing. And those facts, as she says in her pre-sentence report, the facts that are delineated and presented to the trial court are extracted from the complaint. No challenge was raised to that. No question was raised as to that. So whether you're going outside of the four corners of the doctrine of the charging document, that was not an issue raised in the trial court. And in this particular case here, there's nothing to suggest that what the trial court did here was impermissible.
So your view is that the complaint stated these facts, and therefore it was appropriate for the district court to rely on them despite that precedent, am I right?
If I'm saying your question correctly, Your Honor, I'm saying that the pre-sentence report says that the writer of that report took the statements there from the complaint. That's where she got it from. No one has challenged whether or not that was permissible for her to do that. No one is suggesting that there was another doctrine, a document that was required to be relied upon by the trial court. And in fact, I think the case law in this circuit is that if reliance on some other document is impractical in order for the court to make a determination, I think that the Shannon case from this circuit speaks to that issue, that the court is permitted to do that. And in that particular case, the court looked at
it. I'm sorry, it's permitted to do what?
Is the court permitted to draw upon facts to make a determination as to whether or not an offense constituted a crime of violence. And then Shannon, which involves a rape case, which this court determined that, in fact, the mere fact or the facts of sexual intercourse with a minor, considering the inherent risk associated with that, were grounds for the trial court to conclude, Judge Rander, I believe it was, to conclude that there had in fact been a crime of violence committed.
That was an en banc decision, isn't that right?
Yes, sir, that in fact was the case. And I think, Your Honor, I think you wrote a very strenuous concurrent opinion in that case. So for the reasons I've expressed, and I believe my time is up here, I respectfully ask this court to dismiss this appeal, and if it chooses not to, based on the forfeiture doctrine, that it find that there was no error, and even if there were, it's certainly not an error giving rise to a reversal in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Ms. Stotz, what is your reply to your colleague's suggestion that it is appropriate to look at the underlying facts with respect to the firing of the weapon into the home on the ground that they were in the complaint, and you can take a look at the complaint?
Well, there are two problems with that. Even if this was a case where the risk of force or injury was relevant, which it isn't, because 201.2 defines crime of violence differently than every other definition does, and it doesn't include the risk of force or the risk of injury. I think Shannon says that you can't look to a Wisconsin criminal complaint anyway. But the main point is that...
It says what? I'm sorry.
That you can't look to the Wisconsin charging document because there's, unless it's clear that the defendant has admitted all the allegations. But the larger point is that this definition of crime of violence, to meet this definition, you have to have a listed offense or you have to have the use of force as an element of the crime.
Isn't a gun the use of force?
No, discharging a firearm into a building only requires that the defendant intentionally shoot a gun into a building under circumstances that should lead the defendant to believe that a person might be inside. There's no requirement that
you're limiting that. You can, isn't it an offense if you shoot a gun into a building knowing that there is not that person, but anyone inside.
The offense only requires that the circumstances, under the circumstances, the defendant should have known a person might be inside. There's no requirement that a person actually be inside or anywhere near there. So I think it, you could commit this offense if you shot a gun in a building, say, that had a light on or a car in the driveway.
Did the complaint in this case say he knew she was inside? He had to know.
Right. The facts of the complaint do suggest, right, that the victim was right there. But the underlying facts of the way the offense may or may not have been committed simply aren't relevant. It is a categorical approach here. You just look to the fact of conviction and to the statutory definition of the crime and look to whether it has the use of force as an element. As to why I said that government...
So your position is it's either got to be one of the listed crimes under 201.2 or the crime of conviction has to be a crime where an element is the use or threatened use of force.
Exactly.
But otherwise, you're outside the box. So going to the complaint is not helpful or relevant.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And
you, in your view, Shannon stands for that proposition.
It does, but... Right, and then also the point that, as Judge Williams was saying, we don't care about underlying facts here. We only care about elements.
So can you pursue Shannon some more as Judge Ripple raised that? I mean, how should we look at Shannon and then look at this statute? Are you saying Shannon is not applicable given the language of this statute? What's your position on it?
Exactly. Given the language of this guideline, you only need to look and see, is the offense listed and does it have the use of force as an element? And to look to whether it has the force as an element, you just look to the state definition of the crime, the elements. Whatever may be alleged about the particular way in which the crime is committed just doesn't matter.
You can't look at the complaint.
Right.
That's your view.
Thank you.
Thank you. The court will take the case under advisement and proceed to the next.